This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Moses Ben Maimon was born in Islamic Spain in 1138, the successor to seven generations of rabbis. He grew up to be a famed physician to the great and humble, and the most important interpreter of Jewish teaching and tradition in a millennium. Renaissance admirers called him Maimonides, the name that still graces hospitals and academies around the world today. Maimonides has been called Judaism's proto-humanist, the scholar who struggled to reconcile scripture and Aristotle, religion and science. That is a struggle that goes on today. Up next on Point, Faith, Reason, and a new meditation on the great Jewish physician-philosopher Maimonides. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Sherwin Newland. He's a clinical professor of surgery at Yale University and the author of a string of books, including How We Die, Reflections on Life's Final Chapter, which won the 1994 National Book Award for Nonfiction, and Lost in America, A Journey with My Father from 2003. His latest volume is Maimonides. Sherwin Newland, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, what a pleasure.
It's a terrific pleasure to have you. I wish you'd take us first, because we'll have listeners who are keenly attuned to Maimonides, maybe studying in a Maimonides school on this very day, others who will know nothing or little of the man. What's the footprint today of Maimonides in the world, Sherwin Newland?
Well, in the world, the footprint has to do with this reconciling, this conciliation of faith and reason that he devoted so much of his life and so much of his writings to, as a matter of fact. Now, his footprint in the Jewish world is a little more confused than that, because it has to do, on the one hand, with his religious writings and what one might call his scriptural writings, and on the other hand, with this final, ultimate book called The Guide to the Perplexed, which has to do with this reconciliation between faith and reason.
Take us back to 1138 in Cordoba, Spain, Islamic Spain, and the society, the culture in which Maimonides grew up, Sherwin Newland.
Well, here he was born in 1138. He was the seventh, actually, in a line of judges of the Jewish court. His father was the sixth. He was to be the seventh. So they had been in Cordoba, in the south of Spain, the wonderful Andalusia, so-called, during that, well, what it is referred to as the Golden Age of Spain, and it was pretty close to golden. It was a little tarnished. Jews and Christians were not completely equal with Muslims, but they could achieve high positions in government, high positions in literature. It was a good time, by and large, until 1148, when Maimonides was 10 years old, and this invasion took place of a Berber tribe from North Africa, and that changed everything.
Changing things in the direction of requiring Jews in Islamic Spain to profess Islamic faith.
Exactly, and I'm glad you chose the word profess, because they were forced to either convert or die, and what they did was to profess specifically. They converted. Some of them really did convert. Many of them just took the oath but continued living as Jews. This is a stratagem that's been used throughout history, as you know. And some of them just fled, which is what the Maimon family did. They fled initially to an area in southeastern Spain, and for some years they traveled. They wandered from city to city.
And in all that time, the education of the young Maimonides kept up by his father, somehow even on the road. You write that ultimately in the footprint in the larger world that you describe is this dialogue of faith and reason, or religion and science. Of course, this is the 12th century. Now we have a very 21st century conversation going on about, can faith and reason coincide, and religion and science and conflict in creationism and intelligent design debate in the courts and school boards today. Did the tension that we feel today, would that be a tension that Maimonides would have understood, or was there a different kind of general conception of the relationship between religion and science, such as it was in those days? Would he have recognized the tension that we grapple with today?
Well, I think he would have recognized it, but it was not really what he himself was grappling with. We have this wonderful way, of course, of looking back on history through the spectrum of what we know today when people are trying to say things like, well, there's intelligent design or there's completely creationism, or the more perhaps thoughtful people in the community will say, well, these are two totally different ways of thinking and we should separate them, and I can remain, let's say, a devout Catholic or an Orthodox Jew and still remain a scientist. That's not the problem that Maimonides struggled with all of his life, nor is it the problem that contemporaries or people within a century or so of his work struggled with, like Thomas Aquinas or Albertus Magnus. They knew science so well that they couldn't believe that there wasn't some way of bringing science into religious thought. Mm. They were committed to the notion that religion meant progress, that it meant change, mm-hmm. that it meant accumulating the knowledge of the world, of nature, the natural world, and bringing it into religious thought. So this is not a question of two different ways of thinking or choosing one or the other. It's a question for the philosophers of the 12th, 13th, 14th, and even 15th century of taking the new scientific knowledge as it appeared and bringing it into mainstream thought. It was a very progressive way of looking at things.
So help us understand, I want to look more at the history, but the legacy of this man, Maimonides, for the Jewish teaching and faith, part of it very practical within in the Jewish world, a tremendous clarifier of Jewish law.
He was, of course, a master of Jewish law, and he determined very early on when he was in his 20s that because the great majority of Jews at the time knew very little about Jewish law, he was going to explain it to them. And he took this on in two different major projects. The Talmud, the commentary, of course, mm-hmm. on the Torah, on all Jewish law, has two parts, the Mishnah and the Gemara. Now, the Mishnah is primarily law. The Gemara tends to be more discussion, comment, disputation. So by the time he was 30 years old, he had written what I like to call a Cliff Notes on the Mishnah, which was his way of condensing it so that the ordinary man would understand it. And then later, when he was 42, he published another book which had primarily to do with the second part of the Talmud, namely the Gemara. He called this the Mishneh Torah, which really means a repetition of the Torah at 14 volumes, 1,000 chapters. But really what it did was to take the abstruse, sometimes confused and complex teachings of the second part of the Talmud and make it accessible to everyone.
Thereby kind of laying down a wide, open understanding of law that could be shared across centuries.
That's right. And you might even call it, as it has been called by scholars, a constitution for the Jewish people.
We should take us back and catch up with his life as he was doing that. We left him in Fez, where he was in exile from the traditional family home in Islamic Spain, eventually made his way to Palestine and ultimately to Cairo and Egypt into some fairly high circles.
That's right.
How was it that he found himself in the court of the great Saladin as the physician there? Were Jews then as now sought out in medicine? Was he there because he was a Jewish doctor?
Well, partly, I suppose. Actually, I start the book with a chapter that doesn't deal with Maimonides. It's called My Son the Doctor. And what it does, it's a tracing back to Talmudic times of why so many Jews have become physicians and why, at least during earlier times, they were considered to have special knowledge and to be able to achieve certain cures. Mm-hmm. But he was an extraordinary clinical physician that had to do with characteristics of personality, of ethical behavior, general knowledge. And in fact, one of his sisters, was married to a man who was related to a scribe in the court, and he was recommended to be a physician to the court, but he quickly distinguished himself and was appointed physician to Al-Fadil, who was the vizier of all of Saladin's land. So that was a very prominent job for him.
For such a highly placed person at that time, in Saladin's court, would Maimonides have had a kind of philosophical or proto-scientific conversation going on with Islamic scholars' counterparts or not?
Perfectly honestly, Maimonides was so overwhelmed by the time he was in the court of Saladin with his work that he had very little time for philosophical conversations with anyone.
It'd be great to hear some of that. You've got, I think, a bit of a letter that he wrote about the demands of his life in that court. This in response, as I recall, to a Jew who was asking for his advice, and Maimonides responded.
That's right. This was Samuel Ibn Tibbon, who wanted to come from Europe to translate the Guide for the Perplexed into Hebrew. It had been written, of course, in Arabic. And he writes, you know, I live a mile and a half, equivalent to a mile and a half from the palace. My duties to the Sultan, here I'm quoting him, are very heavy. I'm obliged to visit him every day early in the morning when he or any of his children or any of the inmates of the harem are indisposed. I dare not quit Cairo, but must stay during the greater part of the day in the palace. It also frequently happens that one or two of the royal officers fall sick, and I must attend to their healing. Hence, as a rule, I repair to Cairo very early in the day, and if nothing unusual happens, I do not return to Fustat until the afternoon. Then I'm almost dying with hunger. I find the antechamber filled with people, both Jews and Gentiles, nobles and common people, judges and bailiffs, friends and foes, a mixed multitude who await the time of my return. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, go forth to my patients, and treat them to bear with me while I partake of some slight refreshment, the only meal I take in the 24 hours. Then I attend to my patients. I write prescriptions for the various ailments. Patients go in and out until nightfall. And sometimes, even I solemnly assure you, until 2 hours and more into the night, I converse, I prescribe for them while lying down from sheer fatigue. And when night falls, I am so exhausted that I can scarcely speak.
An unbelievable account of the life of Maimonides, a man facing many demands, read there by Sherwin Newland from his new book, Maimonides. Sherwin Newland, a lot of listeners want to join our conversation. I want to begin to turn to them, if I may. Shava is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Shava, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, you know, I grew up in in what we used to call a Unitarian family.
Okay, you, Jewish mother, Unitarian, yeah.
Yes, my mother's Jewish. My father was a Unitarian minister.
Yeah.
And I grew up, I think I first read Maimonides maybe when I was about 13.
Yeah, perfect.
And my father was a chemist before he was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And so the melding of the rational and the religious was very appealing to him in all of this. But there are lessons, I think, in Maimonides which are interesting for modern science in terms of the attitude that he took, because he was very interested in melding the religious and the rational, but at the same time he was condemning superstition very hard.
Mm.
And there's a section, I teach gardening classes sometimes.
Okay.
You have to have a pattern while you're doing gardening.
Right.
There's time.
Does Maimonides help you out?
And Maimonides helped me out because at one point he is talking about condemning superstition, and he talks about all these horrible things that the pagans do to ensure the fertility of their fruit trees, like beating on the branches.
Yeah.
Or having people have intercourse, hanging on a branch.
Right.
Sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the practices that he condemned was this rank superstition the pagans had that if you put dead plant material around the bottom of your fruit trees, they'd bear more fruit.
In other words, if you composted them, maybe he got that one a little wrong.
Right. And I think this is a good lesson for modern scientists, too, in that it's very easy to look at something and say, my God, that's ridiculous. When actually there's some kernel in it. And, you know, we've got this history of people being defensive, I think, about the concept of, well, you know, this is my mystical connection to Godhead, this is my rational thought, but this stuff over here, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And people feel, you know, Maimonides felt just as much, you know, in describing the marriage of the rational and the mystical, felt just as much an impetus that he had to create that barrier between the mystical and the superstitious.
It's wonderful. Shava, stick with us. Sherwin Nuland, come in here. Shava's challenging a little bit the some of the fruit of his rigor in drawing this line.
Well, Shava, of course, knows that Maimonides made plenty of errors, just as everybody writing in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, and carry it right on to the 21st
yeah.
century
mm-hmm.
makes plenty of errors. He was not an experimental scientist. But it was all in a good cause. At that time, it seemed, of course, that piling a lot of herbaceous material around the bottom of a tree was a superstition. And that's why he railed against it. And he considered it very important for him to be the symbol of anti-superstition. He railed against amulets. He railed against magic potions. He, in a number of his writings, he rails against astrology, comparing it very badly to astronomy. And yet, in his medical practice, when things got bad and he had nothing else to offer, he was not beyond occasionally doing some mumbo-jumbo, because his thought was, anything that'll work to cure this patient, I should do. But Shava, of course, is absolutely correct. I just don't want her to be too hard on a 12th century intellect.
But there's a kind of plea here in our modern thinking for not being too rigid, even in the pursuit of rationality and science, I guess being open to what we don't know.
Well, you know, I consider myself a skeptic, and my definition of skeptic is not just to question everything, but to be prepared that anything can be true. And I think as we look nowadays at the various ways of practicing medicine, it is our obligation as scientific physicians to study every one of them, regardless of how foolish or misguided they may seem, because from time to time, indeed, what I might call the Shava phenomenon, the Shava Maimonides phenomenon occurs, that indeed it's very valuable. So I'm really completely with her.
Keeping open that pliable mind. Shava, thanks very much for your call. Joe is calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask how Hermonides reconciled his concept of God, given his anti-supernaturalism, with the Torah, which from the very first verse says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. I'm just wondering how he reconciled that, given the fact that he viewed it all as an allegory. And if you could help me on that, I'm not quite sure.
Maybe too easy to say it's all metaphor. It still stands there as a kind of challenge, doesn't it, Sherwin Nuland?
Oh, yeah. Well, he believed God created the heaven and the earth, as simple as all that, but not that he created it in 6 days. He may even have believed that it was created in the sequence as described in the Bible, but he did not take literally the notion of time or the notion of certain separate eras as they were. I think there are many places in biblical writing that he might have taken literally, but the entire notion is that some of the stories that we have trouble with as rational human beings or as philosophical or scientific human beings would appear to him to have been placed there only because they were great stories, only because they could attract people who could not think logically because they had never been trained to think logically. So what we're looking here is not a rejection of Torah, certainly not all of the principles remain, but a rejection of some of these stories as they are described and written.
But at the fundamental level, to Joe's question, having what interpreted through the stories, still a believer in the sense of a believer based on faith, or something else emerging in Maimonides?
Oh, Joe and Tom, you put your finger on the whole issue. This is what people have been fighting about. There are some people, and a number of Maimonidean scholars have felt this, that underneath all of this, he was not really a man of faith. He was a man of science, and he wanted to keep the Jewish people together, so he behaved like a man of faith and wrote about Talmud, wrote about other biblical wrote about biblical writings, but in fact what he was trying to promote was science. I have a lot of trouble believing that because, as I've said earlier, this is not a notion that appeared until the Enlightenment of the 18th century. At the time that he lived, the thinkers, the serious thinkers, were trying to bring them together. So I'm convinced he was a man of great faith, but also a man of great faith in what science and philosophy might do to enlighten religious belief and ethical living.
So all these centuries later, given that we have a different context, we see what he's meant to Jews over these centuries in terms of unifying and clarifying. For the broader world, what's the bottom line takeaway from Maimonides?
Well, the bottom line takeaway is that you don't have to reconcile science and faith the way he did, but that it is important of men and women of goodwill not to have their faith challenged by the facts of science. And it's very important for the scientific mind not to weaken in its determination to find out all of the laws of nature because they have faith.
It's a view right from the 12th century, and we feel that age all around it. We're grateful for the update. Sherwin Newland, author of the new book, Maimonides, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.